Okay, I mentioned about the Crail Awards, and so the first one is coming up, and this is Donny Tarrant, and he's talking to Debbie Hutchinson about women in 1916.
And you are very welcome to Northside today. This being National Community Radio Day, and I am delighted to welcome to the programme our very own, the beautiful Debbie Hutchinson. Debbie, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Donny.
And for the uninitiated who don't know the reason that Debbie is here, she was central to a programme recorded, produced and broadcast at Near FM, Women of 1916, which we are delighted to say went on to win a Crail Award. Debbie, the genesis of the programme and the way it was put together, can you expand on that for the listeners, please?
Okay. Well, it was originally an idea from within Near FM from a girl called Felicity. I don't know what Felicity's second name is, but everyone in Near FM and everyone listening will know who Felicity is. And she very much had an interest in women in 1916. And as it was 2016 and there was so much being done around 1916, we thought it would be interesting to do something slightly different and to do a series of talks in the library in Coolock. And there's a great team there as well. Paul Daly, the librarian, was really good in terms of becoming involved with the project. So the idea of it is that we do a series of talks around different issues to do with women in 1916. But a nice idea around it was that it would actually be an event. It would be an entertaining event as well. So we also had music and singing from that period of time. As opposed to, there is a lot in the news and a lot in terms of documentaries on women in 1916 this year, because people are looking at different angles of the rising and different stories that haven't been heard. But we also wanted to not just look at the women that took part in 1916, but to actually look at and discuss what life was like, so what the conditions were and what the working conditions were. So,
yeah, and I think that was very much borne out, because there was a whole lot of different aspects to it. I mean, as you say, the conditions they lived in, the rights they had at the time, and I suppose more importantly, Debbie, what really came out was the rights they didn't have at the time, which they subsequently have achieved over the years. And I mean, you know, from one of the parts of it, like the social conditions they were living in at the time, were absolutely shocking, you know. So I think that was very much important that was highlighted. But and it's an interesting thing from a presenter stroke producer's point of view, and it's a question that I love speaking to people in the business about, and I don't want to be boring the listeners now by talking about the intricacies of our business and what goes on behind the scenes. But did you come away with a different perception of 1916 and the women therein, or were you shocked by some of what you heard?
I don't know if I was necessarily shocked. I suppose maybe surprised by something that I heard. Or I think it was more a case of a realisation that I didn't realise the conditions that women lived in, and what I didn't realise was really the lasting effect that 1916 had on women's health and issues around medicine and healthcare for women. Because for a lot of the women that took part in the rising, a lot of them would have been involved in, you know, care for the wounded and have been involved in getting people in from the battlefield. So that was their first introduction to medicine. And then there were actual doctors there, like Kathleen Lynn, who was a really important character in 1916. And I suppose what you didn't realise is how pivotal a role they played, and, you know, how liberal a lot of the leaders were, in terms of, like, for instance, James Connolly, who was a self-proclaimed feminist and actually wanted women to be amongst those fighting in the army, let alone making the tea and tending to the wounded. So I suppose when you grow up in the 70s and the 80s and the influence of the church was so heavy on the position of women, what I didn't realise was that there was this whole liberal, strong group of women and men that were somehow forgotten in history until the centenary.
Yeah, and I think that very much was borne out in the lectures up in the Coolock Library. And I really think that where you could see the link was the fact of De Valera's attitude at the time of 1916 to women, and then the subsequent history where he became the dominant political figure in the country, and where he carried on that ethos that he displayed during the week of 1916, he carried that right on into his political career as he went through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found myself thinking all the time was, what would have happened if James Connolly had lived? That just kept, what kind of a different Ireland would we have had? Because that partnership between De Valera and Archbishop McQuaid certainly defined Irish society and definitely defined roles for women in Irish society. So I found myself thinking that, I mean, there was the story of Elizabeth O'Farrell, whose grandniece was there, Donna Cooney, and she told us that despite having gone through the city and risked her own life, when she got to De Valera in Boland's Mill, he refused to take the notice of surrender off her because she was a woman. That was his only reasoning. He said, until one of the male leaders comes to me with this information, I refuse to take that notice of surrender. So you can see the difference in terms of those leaders of the rising as well. And another thing that struck me about the women's healthcare was there was no maternity or infants hospital in Dublin before the rising, and the death rate, as Pádraig Yates told us as part of one of the talks, the death rate amongst infants in the slums was horrendous. And out of that, because a lot of the women had no, after the rising and the War of Independence, they couldn't become involved in politics. They couldn't become TDs. So instead, a lot of them just said, they took a step back and they ploughed their kind of energies into community work and into healthcare. And that's why we had the National Maternity Hospital, luckily, for us.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, it was one of the shocking aspects that came out of that that whole series of debates and that whole programme, the women of 1916. And I mean, it was something that we knew anyway, or those of us that bothered, I suppose, to look at it knew, was that Dublin, and predominantly Dublin at the time, contained the biggest and the worst slums in Europe, and absolutely, totally ignored by the powers that be. And you would just wonder, and I often wonder, and particularly in this year of the centenary, you know, when you look at the situation in Dublin, and it's a point I have made, and I know I'm digressing from what we're talking about today, Debbie, it being National Community Radio Day, but you just wonder, like, I mean, we had all the discussion about 1916 and what happened, and then we had the, I suppose, which really brought it to a close, which was the British, for want of a better word, sailing up the Liffey and bombing half of Dublin and bombing them into submission. And yet 100 years later, there are more people homeless in Dublin now than there was then.
Yeah.
You know, you just wonder, and I think it goes right back to the kernel of your hypothesis. What would have happened had Connolly survived and taken the reins of power? I just wonder, would things have been different? And, you know, I think, again, being National Community Radio Day and the fact that you're involved in the making of so many excellent documentaries, that it might be an interesting maybe future project for us here to look at that whole connection between Archbishop McQuaid and De Valera going forward, because my understanding of it is, from people that I've spoken to, was that there was no piece of legislation could be enacted until it was got the imprimatur of Archbishop McQuaid at the time, which in today's terms is unthinkable.
Yeah, yeah.
But to think that went on, so, you know.
And that was a partnership forged by De Valera himself. It wasn't forced on him like they forged it. I made a documentary a couple of years ago about a history of the women's liberation movement in Ireland, so particularly focusing on the 60s and the 70s. And what's shocking is just the position of women, even because people think this is something from, you know, years and years ago, but it's not really. I mean, in the 70s, women couldn't sit on the jury. They weren't allowed to sit as jurors.
And of course, Debbie, it's not that terribly long ago since there was the actual marriage bar in place. I mean, that's a very recent thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, recent as in the 70s and up, I think, until, was it there until the early
80s? Yeah.
You know, I mean, and for those of you who are too young to remember, that meant that if you were part in any way of the civil service, once you got married, you had to vacate and leave your position. You couldn't be married and be in the civil service at the time. So, I mean, this is not something going back. It sounds now, in today's terms, like something out of medieval, God knows when, but it's not.
Which it was, probably.
It was medieval thinking.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is only very recent in our history.
Oh, absolutely. And, like, you know, only in the 80s could women get protection from domestic abuse. Actually, men still had the right to come into their... Men still had the right to enter the family home. And it was behoven upon women and their children to leave the house, even if they had a history of you know, terrible abuse. So there was a lot. I think when you look at 1916, what struck me was when I learned about 1916, I thought it was some kind of skiddly-eye Irish thing that, you know, you learned about nationalism and you learned about the leaders of the rising and you learned their names, but there was no real connection with it. And the centenary forced me back into looking at it, and I couldn't help thinking it was a lost opportunity, 1916, that the leadership that came out of Ireland after that was a very right-wing Catholic one, but that didn't reflect the leaders in it. And I always think it was kind of a lost opportunity there in terms of the leaders of the rising. But obviously a lot of them were executed, so that's where the loss...
It did, and of course it continued on now. I know we're definitely stepping outside the realms of what we're here to talk about today, Debbie, but I mean, if you wanted to take that to its ultimate conclusion, it probably continued on with the, what a lot of people would say as well, was the untimely and tragic death of Michael Collins later on, who was, would have been the opposite way of thinking as well, probably very much in the Connolly school of thought. And I mean, he was probably the last one who could have brought about the change which we have never seen. And you know, again, when you listen back to that award-winning documentary that you made, Debbie, a lot of people would argue that the change still hasn't been made. We're a long way from the visions and the ideals of Connolly and the other leaders of 1916. Anyway, Debbie, we'll part the women of 1916. Congratulations, it was exceptional piece of radio and well worthy of the award. What's coming up that we're going to win the next award with, Debbie? What have you got?
Oh God, I don't know. At the moment we're doing a lot of work with schools, and we've just recently finished recording a programme with local primary schools and secondary schools where we look at 1916 again, but through children's literature. So it's through the writings of children's authors. And we also get the local children to produce their own creative pieces around the rising as well. Just a different way of looking at it. So hopefully that will go out in autumn of 2016 as well.
Well, there you are, folks. That is Debbie Hutchinson, our own Debbie from Near FM, and does absolutely Trojan work here with us. And as is testimony and testified by the fact that the documentary, one of the documentaries that won the Crail Award for 2016, was Women of 1916. Debbie, thanks a million for joining us. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Tony.
And thanks to Tony there, talking to Debbie Hutchinson about that programme, Women in 1916. Now, just to mention again, as I did at the start of the programme, this is Community Radio Day, National Community Radio Day. And this time, Alan Bradish talks to Pádraig Naughton, presenter of Arts and Disability Radio. Now, Alan first asks how Pádraig got involved with community radio.
I've had two involvements with community radio. This one now, which is with Near FM, but years ago, it seems a very long time ago now, I was involved in the setting up of Roscom Radio, which became Ross FM in Roscommon Town. And that would have been in 2002. And I made a series of programmes on disability for that radio station. But then I moved to England for work in early 2003, mm-hmm. and that my time in community radio came to an end. And then more recently, I'm just trying to work out now, it's probably about 2 years ago, this time 2 years ago, so it's in May, June, July of 2014, I did the radio course for volunteers with Near FM. Then from there, I did a, I suppose, a once-off programme on Northside Light during August, where I presented one of the Northside Today slots, and then in the autumn put in a proposal for a arts and disability radio, and that 1 hour bi-weekly programme started in January 2015.
That's right, and we'll be hearing an episode of Arts and Disability Radio later today at about 4:30. But of course, the arts content of your programme, that's not something that you just. I mean, some people when they start to do programmes, they start to do things that they have an interest in, but may not have been involved in. But you've been heavily involved in the arts long before that programme proposal, haven't you?
Well, I suppose I've been involved in the arts since I was in school. Although I'm from Roscommon, because I have a visual impairment, I went to school in St. Joseph's in Drumcondra and Pubble School Rosminy. People might better know St. Joseph's now as Child Vision. So I went to school there from the age of eight right through until I did my leaving cert. And had a lot of exposure to the arts, particularly to play and working in sculpture, and after school went on to study for a degree in craft design ceramics in NCAD. Mm-hmm. And then had a kind of a varied and mixed career in the arts from 1993 onwards when I graduated. And I was a studio artist. I did a year's teacher training in Bretton Hall. I was artist in residence at the Richard Attenborough Centre in Leicester University for 2 years, and then I had a studio career in Ireland, which in fact was when I was based in Roscommon, and that took me up to 2003, when I suppose my work in the arts as an arts administrator began, because when I moved to England to take up a job as artist manager with Equata, which was the Disability Arts Development Agency for Southwest England. And I suppose the reason I went to do that was, as an artist with a disability, I saw a lot of things in the arts that I'd like to change and make better for people with disabilities, but didn't necessarily think I could do it from that position as an artist. I always felt like a hurler on the ditch. You know, you could give your opinions, people could decide whether they wanted to take them or not. However, there were no paid opportunities at the time, so I decided to take up this job in England to get experience and to be paid, and to also to be responsible to a board and be responsible to funders. And it's a very different position, and you actually see how the arts works from a very different place when you're in that position. And 2 years later, that led me back to Ireland when the opportunity to become Director of Arts and Disability Ireland came up. And since September 2005, I've been ADI's director and have grown the organisation. And I suppose Arts and Disability Ireland is very much about it's an organisation that champions the creativity of artists with disabilities, and we promote inclusive experiences for audiences with disabilities. And really, I suppose that experience I then brought to bear on Arts and Disability Radio. And I suppose I was interested in creating an opportunity where people could hear what was going on in the arts for people with disabilities in an auditory way, in a way that was almost like an audio magazine, as opposed to maybe reading it on the internet and seeing photographs or seeing short video. So it was almost like an alternative format. And but the other thing was, I love the idea of doing it through community radio, where there was really good studios at Near FM. There was a team behind who could support. You could learn on the job while you were actually doing it. And there were production values, and establish rules. And, you know, from having done the course, you know, understanding how a little bit of what the BAI expects from a community radio station, understanding a little bit about, you know, defamation and libel, and how, you know, your responsibilities as a presenter. I think, you know, if ADI was just to have started making podcasts or short videos that we put up on YouTube, you wouldn't gain that understanding, but you also wouldn't get to put arts and disability radio into the broader context of a community radio station like Near FM, where, mm-hmm. you know, there's programs on jazz and there's programs on local sport on the north side of Dublin. You know, there's a whole variety, I think, of some 85 programs a week going out on Near FM, and they're all different.
So what's new in the future for ADI?
In the immediate, there are a lot of things going on at ADI. For myself, there's quite a bit of travel coming up, in that I've been invited to be a keynote speaker at Arts Activated, which is probably the largest biannual conference that happens in the area of arts and disability in the Southern Hemisphere. And so it's in Sydney in September. And ADI just recently has announced the recipients of the 2016 Arts and Disability Connect Awards, which we manage on behalf of the Arts Council. So there's going to be new work and mentoring and training for 7 artists happening as a result of those awards, which is great. There was just 25,000 awarded across the 7 artists. So that's really exciting. And you know, we have an artist in residence at Access Ballymun as well, Kevin Nolan, who's a musician, and we're working on a show that we're hoping to bring in for the Dublin Theatre Festival with Access Ballymun at the moment. Can't announce it because it's not official yet, but that's in the works. And then, looking a little bit further ahead, there are a lot of changes coming down the track in terms of the arts, and ADI is coming to the end of its current strategic plan, becoming a national resource. And in the 5 years, I think we have become that national resource organisation. So now I suppose the next 5 years, 2017 to 21, which is our next strategic plan, will be very much about how can we I suppose, become more that national organisation where the projects we're doing are, I suppose, impacting more than single organisations at a time and single artists at a time. And that, I suppose, that the change that we're trying to implement in terms of engaging people with disabilities, both as artists and audience, can actually be happening across the country, which is a tall order, but that's the thing we're exploring at the moment.
This is 90.3 Near FM.